working Monday night, and Tuesday might not.
We are joined on Smashing Sundays today by a guest we're so excited about for our Christmas special. We finally have incredible podcaster, spoken word artist, musician, twitcher, although I don't know what that is. We're about to find out. Actor. We're really excited to have you on. He doesn't really need any introduction. It's Scroobius Pip.
Well, thank you for having me on. As you know, I'm a big fan, so I'm excited to be here. So, yeah. Thank you.
We sat and we were kind of... So this is the last... Is this the last ep of series 3? Let's say it is. I think it is.
We don't even know what series we're on.
You know how slapdash we do this. But we were like, oh, we really want to do a Christmas special to come out in December. Who would be perfect? And we were like, Pip.
Perfect. I love
it. Like, he's got the beard.
I'm honoured. Yeah, I'm all Christmassy.
Yeah. We were like, do you think he'll do it? And then when you said yes, we were like, oh my God, we're buzzing about this.
Mate, I love it. The guys I work with at Pod Bible know that they do so much hard work. I'd say about 3 times a year I hit them up and go, I've got a podcast I want to write about. And one of them was Smashing a Sunday. So when that was in there, I did a little review on there. And I said, everyone thinks I'm so involved in Pod Bible. I do so little work, mate. Honestly, it's the other guys that do everything. But yeah, every now and then.
We were so thrilled because we didn't know that we were going to be in it, did we? I don't think you gave us a heads up. And then we just like saw it. Yeah. And we were like, we're in the Pod Bible.
I was at Green Man Festival and I had no signal. And you sent it to me and I got the tiniest bit of signal right out near like a waterfall. And I was so hungover. And I was literally like, guys, I'm absolutely buzzing about this. It was like the only message I got.
It feels like you received it as a message in the bottle just floating to the festival. What's this?
Yeah,
unraveling
exactly.
It.
Yeah, absolutely. I think my brother was even more buzzing than me as
thrilling.
Well.
Thrilling. It was thrilling.
So it was just an excuse to drink more, obviously. Of course. But yeah, no, thank you for that. That's thrilling. We're really, I don't listen to many podcasts, full disclosure, but I do love yours. I find your interview style just really unique, actually, because you don't sort of just sit there and not say anything. It's like we do always learn new things about you, but you have a really, as two people who've been interviewed by you, you have this way, which I think is something you almost can't teach as a skill, where you get people so relaxed that they don't, you lose any agenda you had when you go in. And I noticed that with people, I felt it myself, but also with people you interview. And you just get such lovely information out of it. They always end up being such interesting interviews because you get such brilliant information out of people. And I think it's the way you make people relax and how you make people feel. The one I listened to is most recently, because I listen to them all out of order. It's whoever I fancy listening to on a day. But the Kay Tempest one that you did, where it was obviously you've had them on a few times. But I just felt my heart was so full at the end of it. I was like, oh, I've learned stuff. I've smiled. I've laughed. And I was like, God, that's really not many interviewers. And I know you and Kay have a connection from doing spoken word together for years, and that's something you seem to carry to each interview. But yeah, I'm interested in, my question is for you as an interviewer, did you go into podcasting and interviewing people because you knew you had this skill and you thought, oh, do you know what? People say I'm a good listener and people, you know, have good conversations with me. Or did you start podcasting and be like, oh, I'm class at this?
It was kind of, I just stumbled into it. And it was when they started to get out into the world and people enjoyed them that I got good feedback. Because exactly as you say, I really appreciate all those words there, because the aim has always been to just have them as conversations rather than interviews. And that's where I get bad feedback. If I have someone like a big name on, like Michael Fassbender or whomever else, as some of my favourite episodes, but if their fan base isn't used to it, they're expecting a, here's a question and now over to you. But that's not how conversations work, right?
No.
Like if we're out at the pub, we're not going to say, so how are you? And then sit in absolute silence. When you start responding, we're going to respond because we're friends and we're
that interacting.
That
would be very strange.
Yeah, it'd be really odd. So I'm kind of, it's important to me that I think the key, if there is a key, is that I'm the only person in charge of who I have on. So I'm only having people on who I really want to talk to. So that excitement, and if there is any interrupting, it'll always come from a positive and excited place. It's because I'm going, oh, shit, yeah, you're wearing a Prince T-shirt today. This is amazing. This is so good. And you know, it's a real genuine thing where, yeah, it's a proper conversation. It's not an interview. But I do also relentlessly over-prep for them because of that as well. I don't want to be constantly looking at my notes and going on to the next question. I'll do all my prep last minute. It will please you guys to hear this as you claim yourselves to be disorganized at times. I don't believe it for a second, but I do all my prep like the night before so that it's fresh in my head. So I'm not sitting there going, and the next question is, so that if you bring something up, and when both of you are on, you'd bring things up that I'd read about the night before, so I can excitedly say, yeah, and then you did this, didn't you? And then this happened, and that was with this person, wasn't it? And we can have this genuine conversation rather than it feel like, as said, here's my set questions and on to the next one.
We learnt this quite early when we started doing Smashing Sundays, because it was just like a couple of our friends and like Beth's producer had said, oh, you two are quite funny, like you should have a podcast. Yeah. We're like, what's a podcast?
I don't know if the word quite was in there, but it was a while ago, so I'll let you have that.
And we kind of, probably the first couple, and we were trying to be not rigid, but we, you know, Beth especially, you did a lot of prep, and I mean Tori was the first who you knew, so that helped. But we were
Tori Scott, not a Tori. We've never had a Tori on the podcast.
But we had like we would prep, we'd have all these questions, and then after doing a few, you go, oh, actually, like you said, a relaxed conversation. You just don't know where it's going to go. Yeah. So now I think we approach it. We have a few things that we go, oh, it'd be lovely to talk about that, and you know, and find out about this. But that's the joy of podcasts, is that you can get someone on, think you're going to talk about one thing, and then it'll just go off in a totally different tangent. And I think that's where those little bits of magic are, and that's where you learn a bit about somebody that you might not have learned in just a very kind of rigid interview.
Mm. Yeah, completely. And I think you guys are amazing at that. I remember on the Alistair Green one, we were well into it before. I was like, hang on, aren't we meant to be talking about Sundays and stuff? Like, because he was just going off on tangents and doing his thing. It's like, what even is this podcast now? But it doesn't matter. It's meant to be a conversation. And it kills me when I'm listening to a podcast and the guest says something really fascinating that I want to know more about, and the podcast or the interviewer just moves on and he's on to the next question.
Oh, it's like,
dig into that more. I had one the other day where my guest was telling a story, and the story started with, so at that point, my dad was the voice of Barney the Dinosaur. So I spent a lot of time doing it. And then I went on this long story, and I had to come back and go, excuse me, can we pop back to that? Your dad was the voice of Barney the Dinosaur. And it was just, it turned into this amazing moment and part of the podcast. And they loved it, because I was like, yeah, obviously that's just part of my childhood that is so natural, I don't realise it's a big deal. But yeah, I love stuff like that.
Wow.
That you get to go, no. I get to play the role of the listener. I know as a listener of podcasts, I would be going, we can't leave that there.
We need to go back to that. Yeah.
This is my pet hate with morning television, and I won't name any particular programmes, but there are a few, and you just see the interviewers not really listening. Yeah. And that there's obviously someone in their ear saying, like, ask the next question. And you're like, wait a minute, they just said something that could be really interesting, and you're just totally going, oh, so when's your new album out? And you're like, you're not listening. Yeah. And I think this is why, because you obviously, you started, how long have you been podcasting now? You got in there real early.
So yeah, I'm on, I think, 8 or 9 years now. So it's been a while. But before that, I had 1 year of having a radio show on XFM. And that was one of the things that made me want to do podcasting, was I loved having the radio show, but there was a rigidity to it. You did have your links and your gaps and your pauses. And also around that time, I did a couple of episodes of an online TV show, which I was the host. And it was the only time I had a producer in my earphones. And I was like, I'm never doing this again. Because exactly as you say, someone in front of me is pouring their heart out about an amazing story, and I'm being told right, we need to move on to this, and then we're going over here and doing that. And it's like, nah, man, I can't do that to the person in front of me. I need to say, oh, were you all right after that? Like, are you cool now? Are you happy talking about this kind of thing? Because, yeah, rather than just, and over to you, on to the next person. It's bad,
and it's such a skill to those people that do it well, the radio and the TV stuff. But yeah, that,
like, Sean Keaveney's amazing at it. Like, he's my DJ hero. Yeah. I mean, I'm not embarrassed to say I cried when he lost his breakfast show, and then I cried when he lost his afternoon show, both times, because he's my favourite radio presenter of all time. Saying that, I never listened to your XFM year, so
no, give it to Sean.
Full disclosure,
I bow to Sean comfortably. Yeah, he's absolutely amazing.
He's just a masterclass in radio, and how he, his interviews he does with people, they're just, he really beautifully holds space, and he's really funny and considered, and he's one of those people who, within those constraints, I think manages that so well.
Yeah, you know, though, that, shout out to his producer, because they've got an amazing relationship. So
Phil?
He's not going to have someone in his ear who's just going, now everyone, he's going to know the nature and the pace of it, so they're going to have worked together so well. So, yeah.
Lovely. Yeah, exactly. Sorry.
Sorry, I was going to say, you don't have to say who it was, but have you ever done a podcast or a radio interview where you've just been like, this is hell?
Yeah, it was Dylan Moran.
Really?
Moran, isn't it? I've got the name wrong. I pronounce it, Irish people get mad at me. But it wasn't his fault at all. It was my fault 100%. And it was because I got offered him last minute. I was still recording at the XFM studios at that point. It was on my podcast, but they were really kind and were letting me use their studios a lot. And one of my old producer said, look, we've got Dylan coming in. Do you want to get some time with him for the podcast? I was like, yeah, sure. But I didn't have time to do as much prep as I wanted. But weirdly, his name is a name I've always used to illustrate my stammer, because it's a name I always stammer on unless I tap it out. So if I just try and, like, my hands were down the first two times I said it, if I just try and say Dylan Moran, I get stuck. Whereas if I tap out the syllables, Dylan Moran, I can say it.
Wow.
So it's really weird. It's fascinating. It fascinates me how the brain works, how the mind works, how language works. So because I had that connection, I was like, this is going to be an amazing episode. And up until that point, similar to you, I'd only had people on who were my pals. So it was really easy. It's just these casual conversations. So I get Dylan on, and I've done a bit of prep, but not enough. And I get to this story. I tell him that. I show him that. And he kind of goes, all right. And I'm like, Black Books. And it wasn't his fault. You can't expect your guests to have the reactions that you want them to have if they're unprepared as well. So I was expecting that to be a 20-minute tangent where we talk about language and names and all sorts of other stuff. But it didn't go there.
Gosh.
So I was then, it was in the first 10 or so episodes I'd ever recorded. So as an amateur at that point, I then knew I was clambering. And loads of people have listened to that episode and said it's great still. But I know in my mind, the rest of that episode, I was, how do I fill the hour or the 45 minutes or whatever it is I was expecting this. So yeah, that's...
Imagine 40 minutes in. Did you watch EastEnders last night?
Exactly.
When was the last time you watched The Bodyguard?
But genuinely, now at this point, I'd be comfortable with that kind of thing, because I found that be the most interesting bits is when you don't talk about their career or their life, when you just find something that is a connection. Again, another thing that every now and then I'll get backlash for, but I feel is a key part of my style of interviewing, is I'll always try and find a connection. Now that means quite early on I'll be talking about myself, so I'll be saying, oh, I had this thing where I did this, but the point of that is, as you say, to get the guest relaxed. So with everyone, I'll try and find something. If it is, as said, Beth, when you had a Prince t-shirt on and we could talk about Prince and things like that, finding those things early on that to a listener it might seem as if you're trying to make it about yourself, but if it's not someone you know well, it proper puts them at rest, because you're connecting over something other than interviewer and interviewee.
Yeah.
Kind of thing.
Even if it's a mutual friend or a mutual discipline, my touring days or acting or whatever else, I'll try and get something in early to make them go, all right, this isn't simply I'm being interviewed to promote my new film. We're having a conversation about the industry or about Prince or about whatever else it may be, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
And I think
it's that friendly thing.
I didn't find anything.
Can you? Were you like a week later in the shower going, shit, I could have talked to him about that?
Yeah.
Like when you've had an argument.
There was loads later.
I've done loads of things like that where I go, oh, I can't believe I didn't say that. Yeah. Oh, I'm absolutely I did this like Scottish TV interview when I was doing my play up in Edinburgh. And I just, you know, when you get have that sense of unease, which you obviously had after that, where you just go, oh, I just wasn't. That was an opportunity that I just kind of, you walk away from some things going, oh, that was fucking great. And I've had a few, and it was this weird Scottish telly TV thing. It haunted me for about 10 days afterwards. Yeah. So I was like, why didn't I say that then?
Yeah.
Just the zone I was in. And again, that agenda thing, like going in with a hard, and you learn the hard way, right? Mm. Of going in, going, oh, this is the thing that I'm going to talk about. We're going to talk about that for about 20 minutes. And you go, right, well, I'm never doing that again. I learned the hard way. So I went in and I think I was like, oh, I'm going to go in and talk about this because this happened at our show last night. And that'd be really funny. Because someone had tried to get in the door. It was in a working hair salon and mad stuff used to happen all the time. And this drunk guy had tried to get in and I'd handled it so fucking well. You've never met anyone so in character in your life as I was in that moment. You know, when you're like, was anyone filming that?
Because
it just, the moment he tried and he's drunk and then the way I just, because it, we had an audience in a hair salon, but we weren't, there was no audience interaction. They were just there. Yeah. So there was certain things that would happen where you'd have to just ignore it or go with it if you could without it compromising the integrity of like the play or the performances, you know? Because anyway, this guy absolutely smashed it. And I thought, well, that's interesting. That happened last night. This is on TV. And then the first thing they asked me, she just took me straight away from that. And then I was like, I spent the rest of the interview just thinking about that and how I was going to get that in.
Yeah.
Because I thought, oh, that'll make people want to come and see it. Or, and I just...
It's mad,
I
was, isn't
why
it,
Why
though?
Didn't I say that? Why didn't I do that?
Because and they so always say that the professionals are meant to have that. Like... Because I always struggle. I always go into interviews with, I'll see what comes up. But you realise when, or since YouTube has come about, really, you realise that Will Smith is telling the same anecdote on the American chat shows as he is on Graham Norton, as he is on here, because they've got that prepared. So you did the right thing. You were a professional there going in with, here's my anecdote. But yeah, I guess sometimes it doesn't. It doesn't last.
You can't be too.
We almost have like whenever we do a podcast, we almost have like it's like hangover anxiety, isn't it? Afterwards, where we'll both ring each other and go, well, "How was it? Oh, I think I was dreadful.
Yeah.
I don't know why I said this. I don't know why I talked about that and didn't talk about." We both then will listen to each other's and go, "Oh no, you came across really well." But we both because it is
we're both lying to each other, obviously. Yeah. But you know, we've got some people are still listening, so it's fine.
At some point, I'm going to have to get you both on. We do normally at the end of the year, and we've moved it this year with Stu Whiffin and Chris Glass, and we do our end of year drunk casts, and every now and then we have guests on. That is a recording that you feel weird the next day because you have you have genuine hangover anxiety and podcast anxiety, and it's all all just mixed into one.
I'm loose-lipped. I'm so loose-lipped when I'm drunk, aren't I?
Oh god, yeah.
A couple of pints in and loose fingers texting wise. Yep.
That's some of the beauty messages. Of the drunk cast though, and again, it's why I love doing it because it's genuinely. As stupid as it sounds, I chose my two mates who I'm like, right, I know, drunk or sober. They're good people. So we will say stupid things and ridiculous things and probably offensive things, but we won't say nasty things and we won't say horrible things. And again, the kind of the beauty of them, particularly on the early ones, was we'd get an audience who were up for listening to three blokes with kind of this kind of accent get drunk, but maybe wouldn't watch a documentary about trans rights or numerous other things. And we'll get drunk and end up talking about these things and talking about how ridiculous it is to be scared of genders and of all these different things. And it really felt that we could address big things to people who wouldn't seek out those conversations, if you know what I mean. Again, to be clear, we also end up just smash making weird noises. Chris genuinely believed he invented 21 questions. On one of them. He came up with this game and we play it every time now, and he believed at the time. So what it is, I'll think of someone and you ask me questions like, yeah, this is a very known game, but in his drunk mind, he's like, I've invented a game. But yeah.
That my brother does that sober, right? And it's so funny. This one day we were in my mum's kitchen and he always is like, comes up with things, doesn't he? So excited. Yeah. Like he was in the kitchen and he went, oh, and he'd like opened the fridge for the third time. And he went, oh, I'm so fucking sick of looking in the fridge. And then he shut the door and went, just all the cold's getting out there. And he said, I don't know why every time I close and open it, I think something else that I actually want to eat is going to be in there, but it's not going to be in there. And then he shut the door and he went, oh my God. He went, how class would it be if, he went, imagine, right, like the front of the fridge, then you could just see through it. So you didn't have to like open it every time. He went, it's supposed to be quite hectic. Like if you had a messy fridge and you had people coming around, but like, so you'd have to keep it quiet. But like, imagine not having to do that action of like opening and closing the fridge. Like imagine, right, the front door was, I don't know, like glass and you could just see everything that was in the fridge. You didn't have to keep doing that. I went, what, like the ones they've got in every shop you've ever been into? Yeah. And he was like,
have you been to a pub?
Yeah, of course. And he was like, oh my God. So I was like, he does those all the time. Like that nature of like inventing shit that's already, there's so much comedy in that. And I've used it as a device, I think, in my series off the back of Joe doing that.
I did that with a film. I did that with a film. I thought I had a really good, a good idea for a film. And then I told my friend and he was like, yeah, no, that was made. It was an absolute
two guys
bomb.
In a basement that have a cable TV show and love Aerosmith. Shit, someone's done it.
Lucy, the worst part is when you have a really good idea for a film and then you find out it's been made and it's a shit film. You're like, oh, right, turns out I had a really shit idea for a film. I had that recently. I've had this film that I've been trying to pitch about for ages and I had to look someone up on IMDb for something and I went on a bit of a rabbit hole. And I found the exact film.
You found
and it
the
looks
film.
So bad. It's everyone in it is awful. It got like 2 out of 10 or whatever. I was like, yeah. And in the little description, it's almost word for word what I'd written in my pitch.
So,
but it was years
it's
ago.
Mad,
I was like,
isn't
oh man.
It?
They saved you from it.
This is what I had. I think it was either Liam or Edgar. I was telling them about it, and they were like, yeah, no, it's been made. And so, like someone like Al Pacino or fucking Robert De Niro's it. I was like, oh, I've got this really good idea about like a fake, like a movie studio creating, like I've told you about this, creating like a fake film star that everyone then falls in love with, but it's just like a holiday, it's an AI thing, and it's this, the pretense of them trying to keep up that this person exists. I was literally saying it, I think it was Liam, was like, yeah, it's been made, it was made in whatever year, and it was an absolute bomb, and so and so was in it, and I was like,
Well, I would have had a good director, so that wouldn't have happened if I'd made
that
it.
That said, I've got a theory, and this is, again, we're going off on tangents. We've not discussed Sundays at all yet, as said. But
Or Christmas.
Or Christmas.
It's fucking snowing outside. We haven't even mentioned Christmas.
Every time, like, this came to mind when a mate of mine was talking about they're doing a remake of Roadhouse. And he's like, why are they remaking Roadhouse? He was like, it's awful. And my argument is, awful films are the ones you should do remakes of.
Yes.
And get it right.
Yeah.
If it's an idea that hasn't been pulled off, get it right. If it's a really good film, we don't need a remake because it's
Leave
been done.
It.
But remakes are
literally
bad
literally where my brain
exactly
went when you were
happen.
Saying that. Yeah, exactly. So it's like, well, I could have done it better then. Well, yeah, exactly that. It's like, yeah, why would you remake? There's some things they're remaking. And you're like, well, that's perfection. Don't touch it. Yeah. Like, so yeah, exactly that. Go, well, there was a reason someone made that and picked up that idea. So it's a good story, but it wasn't
and
executed well.
And the fact that
we've
all heard of it, there must be something in it. But if you think it's bad, then let's make a good version of it. I love it. I'm all for that.
Yes. The Kickstarter for that would be class. Yeah.
Let's remake shit films better.
Yeah.
Love it.
I think we're on to something.
What would you do? What Roadhouse,
Or Roadhouse is being made at the moment. I'm trying to think. I don't know. I like a lot of bad films as well. Like I think if an idea is good, like I like all of the Purge films as an example, just because I think it's a really good idea. I don't think they're made perfectly, but I just think as a concept, the idea that we are all allowed on one day to do anything we want to get it out of our system. It's a beautiful idea. I've pitched it as a relationship structure before. that we have a purge week, that we don't see each other, and we go off and do what we want, and then we're back to being in a loving relationship. You know, I think the purge idea in general...
There's your film.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is a fucking film. Should we edit that out in case someone steals that idea? And if someone does a shit version of this, you'll be like, right, they listened to that bloody
podcast.
There
we go, they got it. But yeah, I love the idea. And as I said, I like anything that's a concept like that. So I think the Purge films, they're trashy and throwaway, but you could make a really highbrow version of them that is really good. But yeah, I don't know.
Definitely. Yeah, and different versions of that where you just had certain professions that you focused on. Do you know what I mean? Like, what would a corporate lawyer do if they could purge for a day? What would somebody who, you know, someone who worked in, like, Waitrose do if they, you know, could purge for a day? Look at all
the
different,
get on the
like,
phone to Apple or Netflix.
Pockets. Yeah. while you're here. Yeah, like different pockets of people. I love those things that takes a concept like that and you get, like, a different episode each time, you know? Like, in treatment with the different...
Because we've got the public... used to the idea of cinematic universes kind of thing. It's such a normal thing now. Everything wants to have... There's a TV show that's part of it and this and that. I think the more we can do that with any good concept, I think it's a great idea. Because as you say, if the initial concept is strong enough, then you can get like an indie director to come up with a really intimate personal thing on Purge Day, or as just using that as an example, probably not the best one, but
yeah.
And then you can have, as you say, the big highbrow and all sorts of stuff.
It's interesting because do you find that you lead, because obviously I'm a writer and I've learned so much about how I write and how I want to write over the last couple of years after writing lots of episodes of things, and I'm currently writing a TV show which is very much based on my kind of lived experience. So it was an idea that I pitched because I'd lived it and this production company were like, oh yeah, great, we love it, right? So it's actually something we talked about when you interviewed me that ended up after that getting picked up, right? I was sort of having the beginnings of the idea when we chatted because I talked about other jobs that I'd done and stuff. But I always had this really, because people would always say, oh, you know, we'll go in, we'll pitch like five ideas. And it would just send this panic into my body because I'm not really a concept person. I lead very much from characters, creating characters and living things and having experiences and worlds. And I think I'm not somebody who comes up with concepts often at all. Like, they strike like lightning for me once every 10 years. Well, less often than lightning, famously. But like... it's really not very often I come up with ideas. And it was such an insecurity of mine for such a long time because people would go, oh, I've got this idea, and people would pitch this idea to me. I think I never think of ideas.
I think of the complete thing. And I really, my biggest struggle as a writer is I obsess over the idea that I'm working on. So, for example, I've got a feature script at the moment that I can't think about anything else. And I'm in the process now of figuring out how to make it next year kind of off my own back as such. But there's a lot going on behind the scenes there. But the problem with things like that is, like, my agent will get me a meeting about a TV show or about something else, and I'll be like, but I want to make this. Like, this is what I'm thinking about. Yeah. Or even a script I wrote 3 years ago, someone will come in for a meeting on, and I'll be like, all right, yeah, I guess so. But it's like, I'm not excited about it. What I'm focused on, I get really tunnel vision on, on whatever is the latest. And that's a blessing and a curse, I guess. A blessing in that.
I think that that comes into, like, we always talk about how we can be quite obsessive. And I think, was it Mae Martin's show where she talks about, like, that thing in that certain people's brains, the way that they... function is that it is that thing of like, no, I want that, and I want that to come off, and I can only concentrate on that. And I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing. It's like you with your script, you had kind of two ideas running at the same time, but the one that's gonna be made, like Beth kept saying, oh, I'm gonna give them both, but I really want them to take that one. And we were like, they're both amazing, but we were like, well, they're gonna take that one because it is amazing. And it's, I think sometimes having the faith in that thing, it comes across, your passion for that comes across. So it is hard. I mean, I'm not a writer, but you two as writers, I can understand the frustration of people going, oh yeah, what else have you got? And it's like, no, but this is really good. Yeah. This is an amazing idea and I can do this really well. Let me do this.
Yeah, especially when it's sort of, you're trying to create something in the world that I've definitely noticed this with certain things where I'm like, no, what's happened to me now as I've got older and I've got this experience? It's less about, oh, this will be funny and this will be... It's about, yes, it has to be funny because I write comedy, but also I'm identifying what I didn't have growing up, what doesn't currently exist for me, and things that I feel really strongly have to be in the world. Yeah. So is that sometimes for you as well, where you go, no, this needs to be in the world, and that's your ultimate drive, because why are we doing 100% that if not, right?
Again, I'm lucky the podcast really feeds me creatively, like personally. So two people, and they couldn't be more different, Boots Riley and Kevin Smith. Now, Kevin Smith spoke about how he got successful and then tried to become kind of a Hollywood director. And then after his heart attack, he had a realisation. He's like, well, no one else can make Kevin Smith films. And then derogatory to himself, he said, no one else really wants to make Kevin Smith films. So it's my responsibility to make Kevin Smith films. And yeah. I love that. But Boots Riley as well, to speak on what you were saying there also. Boots Riley made, sorry to bother you, as his directorial debut, and it's amazing, but it's absolutely bonkers. And I had him on, and I was like, how did, as a first-time writer-director, how did you get to make this film? Because it's so crazy. And he said quite bluntly, he's like, because I wasn't trying to make films, I was trying to make this film. It wasn't me going about going, oh, I want to be a director. He's like, I want to make this film. So this was the only eventuality that could be, if you know what I mean. And that was massively inspirational to go, oh, yeah.
That's really inspirational.
I'm not trying to get in the industry. I'm trying to make my stories, and that's the important bit. So, yeah. And then Sorry to Bob, you came out and was nominated and won loads of awards and is, you know, a classic now. So, yeah.
That's literally the most inspiring thing I could have heard today, because I do get those bits of anxiety where I'm a bit like, oh, how come I'm not writing on that show? And why have I never been asked to work on? And ultimately, all I want is to make my thing that I want to make and write. Yeah. So actually just focusing on that and going, no, this is the thing, and hearing successful people doing that, I'm like, no, this needs to be in the world. And I feel really strongly, and I feel like only I can write this. And I feel like this is going to be banging, so can you just let me try? Yeah. Rather than going, like you say, in general, I want to be in that room with that person, or I want to try and get to write on that, or maybe that would be a good way of... I think that's why I functioned for years as, you know, a nanny and a teacher and doing all different kinds of market research, all different kinds of, like... yes, I am a woman over 50 that uses Elnet. Thank you. I will take £50 on Zoom for that.
It's for connecting the dot. It's that.
I'd rather do that than try and desperately write on other people's show. So it's about going, I've got a vision, I've got a passion. So at least if I just try, I can't have any regrets. If I just try and make my thing that I really want to make. And that's where I came from theatre, because you can do that. You've got a certain amount of autonomy, like especially in the UK, it's sort of a horrendous thing about the fringe is also the best thing about the fringe, because if I had to pay everybody equity, I've always paid people for people that have done work for me, but the fact you can put stuff on not at industry rates and get it out there in this country, right, is, and podcasters obviously created a version of that, which is amazing that you can create work and have a showcase and let it speak for itself. It's like, let it do well. No one has to give you permission. Yeah,
of course. Exactly. And I think that's where we are. I was talking to my accountant about this weirdly, and this all comes into the fact I'm going to try and figure out how to make this film without a major studio. But he was saying how it's really interesting because film does feel like it's where music was about 10 years ago, where there is suddenly a few of the walls are coming down just because of the access and availability to kit, access and availability of things like YouTube or whatever else, ways of getting things out there if you want to. The fact that there's been, like, Oscar-nominated films that were shot on iPhones and stuff like that. Tangerine was up for loads of awards and was shot on an iPhone. And, you know, it does make you... It's still not quite where music was, where it suddenly went, oh, everyone who's got a laptop has got a studio now. And you can just become
Garage
a producer in your bedroom. But it's going... We're kind of in a weird... We're getting in that direction. It's more and more realistic to go, you know what, I've tried to do it the traditional way. Now, fuck that. Now let's make it my way, and we'll make it right.
Yeah, because it's... I'm really interested in how, like, comedy's evolved on the back of that. So you look at these sort of high production sketches, and I watched some stuff that was made and commissioned, made and produced in the comedy world this year. And I was like, do you know what? I've watched 10 minutes of that. Some shorts were made, some half an hour. And I'm not like knocking people's stuff, but like nothing made me, I watched half an hour of some things and some shorts, and not one of them made me laugh anywhere near as much as Alistair Green holding a camera up to his face. And I'm like, have we evolved past these things? And it's something I'm thinking about writing this series now. I'm like, I need to give more. I need to justify. If someone's going to sit down and commit to this series, like, I need to work so much harder. I think originally with, you know, sitcom, and there's so many incredible sitcoms, but at the same time, people wanted to sit there and see jokes. And now we can pick up Twitter and Instagram and have all these people, Meg Stalter being fucking hilarious, putting a camera to her face for a minute and a half, and you're absolutely creasing and sharing it with friends. And, you know, so I'm really going on a journey of going, okay, well, that's out there now. Nobody needs to. And we've got this sort of system where we can, you know, I always chuck money at content creators that I like, you know. If I'm on my thing, I'll be like, right, I'll buy them a coffee, I'll do that. We've got this way of dividing money between us, because I'm like, nobody really, Channel 4 or BBC don't need to give Alistair Green permission. He can put his videos on, his fans can support him, he can hire a cinema and show his videos back to back. Like, this is exciting. And I'm like, okay, I reckon if that had been available to me probably in my early 20s, I would have been all over it and probably now deleting the stuff that I but like characters and those bits was how I started. That was me. I had a little camcorder that I sent to Ruth Jones what I'd done, and she gave me Gavin and Stacey from it. So I dread to think if I'd been allowed a platform like that, I would have gone nuts with it.
How we consume.
But now I'm past that. I don't really, for various reasons, I'm not doing that, but I love the people that are. But I'm like, okay, what's my place in all of this? What am I going to make and write? It's really the evolution of it is sort of scary, because we go, oh, I trained for a world that doesn't exist anymore. Yeah. And I was like, oh, I was going to do that. So now I can't, or I have to do it differently. But I guess it keeps you on your toes, right?
It's just riding that wave, isn't it?
I said, it's such an exciting realisation to go, right, I don't have to be them. The thing that I've got is me. As simple and stupid as that sounds, it means you can stop comparing yourself, because again, it's all of the industries all three of us have been in are channeled towards comparing yourself to everyone else. And I think it's such a great moment to go, oh no, actually, fuck that. it's not about, I don't need to try and become them. I need to make sure I harness me as much as possible, and what I'm doing and what makes my voice unique.
Have you always had that in every aspect of all the kind of different careers that you've done? Was there anything where, like, we all get imposter syndrome, don't we? Was there any one of those things, whether it be the acting, the spoken word, poetry, the pop, was there anything that you thought, I'm out of my depth here, that you got over? Or have you always just been like, I'm just going to try this, let's just see where this goes?
This is going to sound like I'm joking, but the place I've always been the most overwhelmed and felt imposter syndrome is when I've worked in retail and in shops.
Really?
Just because, again, this is me just sharing all the breakthroughs I've had in recent years. But with music, basically, didn't expect it to happen. So from day one, the fact that thou shalt...
Didn't you work in HMV?
Yeah, I worked in HMV. Yeah. And Thou Shalt Always Kill was recorded in my bedroom at my mum's house. I lived at my mum's house still, and we released it and it got in the charts. And it shouldn't... The beauty of that, I'm really lucky that that happened, because it got in the charts despite not having a chorus or a hook. It didn't have the verse structure, like the verse-chorus structure. It didn't have the thing now of you've got to start the vocal within 4 seconds or whatever else. So because we made a song that broke all the rules and it worked, it meant that we could go, oh, we can do it our own way then. But the big thing that I've realised with imposter syndrome, and the reason I don't often get it, is imposter syndrome is worrying that you maybe aren't meant to be there and you don't belong there, right? I know that for a fact, so I can just enjoy it. I don't have to worry about that. I'm a kid from...
I know I'm not meant to
be here. I'm a kid from a small town in Essex who's got a stutter. I shouldn't have been doing music. I shouldn't have been doing broadcasting, acting, all of these things, working class, I've never gone to any drama schools or anything. All of this was already out of my reach. So I can just comfortably go, this is mad, isn't it? let's just fucking enjoy it kind of thing. So every set,
yeah, let's ride this wave.
I feel exactly the same. Yeah. I think the most I've ever felt overwhelmed was probably my first proper job out of sixth form working at an architect's firm, and I didn't have a fucking clue what I was doing. And I just remember thinking, I can't work like this for the rest of my life. I don't know what, I don't understand. Like, I was meant to be filing and putting things into the computer, and I thought, I don't know how to do any of this. Yeah. And I just remember thinking, this is too much responsibility for me, and being really overwhelmed. Yeah. Anything after that, I feel like was a bit of a walk in the park.
Yeah, completely.
Oh, I'm the opposite. I've always, like, when I waitressed and all of those things, I was like, I'm fucking class at this. And like, and then getting into rooms, I get this like, and writing things. And I think it's just a hangover from like, I've got ADHD, and I talked to the psychiatrist about it recently because I'm taking medication for it now, and it's changed my life. It's incredible. But I have this fear of like writing because it's an academic thing, and people have talked so much about, oh, you know, you'll destroy your life trying to write a script, and it's all like, oh, one person created this. And it's like, no fucking one person creates anything, get fucked. And all these myths surrounding it and how it's always been held up by the sort of like upper classes in society. And I went to a state school in Barry where if I was a boy, they would have been like, you're going to be in prison. But because I was a girl, they're like, oh, you're not clever enough to do anything, like, go and do this beauty course at Barry College.
You're not clever enough to get into prison.
But like, I was told, like, yeah, exactly. Like, go to prison. There's loads of books there. Go there. That might, those constraints might help you learn. But yeah, I was like, my schooling was, and he helped me realise just how damaging it was, being told that you're not clever and you're not good all the time and you won't ever be able to do anything and you can't, you're useless and you can't concentrate and you're, you know, you just, that does, as much as you have then other people give you, other validation, you, that still sits in you. And so I still get that.
But look at what you've already done. Like, it's already more than any of them told you you should have done or by any right your background. So everything now is gravy. So you should be able to just enjoy it. You should be able to go, I've done all of this. Look at the TV shows I've done. Look at the live things I've done. Look at the radio stuff I've done. This is all so far above what I would have been expected to do. So you can just...
It just makes me go, what if that was the last good thing I could do? I have this like, oh, that was, I did that, that was a fluke thing. Like, isn't that lucky that that happened? And then I'm like, well, the next thing. And the good thing about it is my standards are fucking high. So like, I go, this has to be amazing. Yeah. I turn up to writers' rooms with sketches where there might be someone else who goes, I have this idea about, you know, if giraffes were window cleaners. And you're like, well, is that an idea? Is that funny? Have you just thought of that before you got on the call, whereas I would have spent 4 days. Because they were definitely, that's what happened to me. Yeah. And I don't know why that came into my head. It's the meds it is, and two coffees. But I'm like, whereas I would have spent 3 days before and I've prepped fully formed sketches that if I need to go away and write them, I can. So it makes me over prepare. Yeah. It makes me, I think, over deliver. So there's good aspects of it, but I love, you know, what you're saying and doing, which is that, oh, I'm fucking here, I'm having a great time. And I do.
And it is that thing of just accepting, like you said, Pip, we're so kind of brought up to compare and to go, oh, I want to be like that person. And I do think, I don't know if it's an age thing, when you do get to that age, and I know it's a bit cliched, when you're like, no, I'm the only me. I'm the only, like, you were writing your scripts. It's like, no one else can, because Beth at the beginning of writing the script was like, fuck, what if someone else has got the same idea? I was like, but it won't be the same, because this is about you. This is your experience. No one is you. So you just have to go, well, this is me. This is what I'm creating, and hope that it does well, or hope that you kind of go, I'm proud enough of this, and I've put the work
in.
It's
just annoying as a grown-up when you realise that all the clichés they told you as a kid were actually true. So just be yourself.
Isn't it? It's
like, that was really the answer. Fuck. You said that at the time. Yeah. I was like, you idiot. Yeah. It's not that simple. And then you're old, you're like, it was. They were right on that. It is just be your damn it. Yeah, it was so simple. I've ignored it for
100%,
so long.
100%.
I know this is a bit of a sharp left turn, but like I said, ADHD, that just made me think about being yourself. Your recent Instagram posts that I've been obsessed with about your facial hair. Yeah. Fucking hilarious. Have you seen all
these facial
hair ones?
Facial hair.
Because
really
part
is.
Of, obviously, as we said at the beginning, about your beard. So we were like, Christmas, obviously, that's going to be class.
it wasn't the only reason.
Perfectly. No, it really wasn't. But no, that visual is stunning. So can you just talking of being yourself, is your facial hair like representative? Is that part of your authentic self? Can you just talk our listeners through your facial hair journeys?
It's genuinely kind of a weird and interesting and conscious thing, because I first grew a beard for function. It sounds insane. No, I'd quit my job at HMV and I was going to be touring the country, living in a van, trying to make it with my music. So I'd saved enough to do a year of just trying to drive around and play on street corners and that. Wow. And I thought, if I'm living in a van, I'm not going to want to have to shave. That's really an awkward thing that men have to do. Yeah. So I started growing a beard about a month or two before I started going on the tour. But then there's also, I then started to realise that at that point, I had a big beard, I'm 6'4", I'd always wear a suit and a trucker cap for all my performances. It's really easy to remember. So it did become a really good bit of marketing. Because it's like, brand. If you're doing a spoken word night, you can say, the big bloke with the beard, rather than the guy who was doing this. You know, it really made me easily identifiable, particularly considering I'd given myself a name that's hard to remember and pronounce and say. So, yeah, it then became kind of a key part of my branding. And when to the extent that when I did my first solo record after me and Dan Lesac had blown up, the first single on it was called Interdiction, and the music video, I only had 100 quid, and the main idea I had was, I did it as a one-shot video, there's some mad stuff going on, but the key thing I came up with was I need to cut my beard and hair off in it, because it made me go, right, everyone who's a fan of my music with Dan, if they hear I'm cutting my beard off in a video, they'll at least come and have a look. And then if they like the song or not, who knows? But it was key. And in the end, I was using scissors, so I only came down to like here or whatever, and it was in one take in a song as I'm performing. So, but yeah, it was. It's
great.
Been kind of a key tool. And weirdly, it was reported. I'll confess the full truth of this story now. I eBayed my beard after cutting it off in Interdiction. It got written about in NME, in all sorts of press. And this is a solo record.
It's like a PR machine.
This is a solo record I'm putting out on my own label, so I had no money for PR. So it worked perfectly. The person who bid for it ended up disappearing and not paying. I've still got that beard upstairs in a little Ziploc bag. So
how much?
Oh my god!
As you say, it was more valuable as a bit of PR than actually as
Who
cares
about
selling a beard? But it got some press and news stories because I just did it on my socials. I was like, right, who wants to buy my beard? Here's my eBay account.
That's hilarious. That's amazing. Who wants to buy my moustache?
Do you mind saying, yeah, I know, mine's getting a bit, actually. For what it's worth, so we'll find out.
The beard has kind of been key, but it's been really interested in the acting thing, because I've really wanted a role where I can cut it off, because I think I'll feel more like a different character in it. But because not loads of actors have big beards, everything I get cast in, they're like, no, we want the beard. The beard's perfect. It's really good for this character. It stands out. So, when I did a Venom 2 a couple of years ago, I really wanted to just have a big, scary handlebar moustache, because I was playing this madman. I was like, I want to shave it all off, maybe even have it like continuing the length it is, but just shave chunks out of it. But they were like, you're playing a lunatic in an asylum. You've got a huge beard. It looks like you've been here for ages. That's what we're going for. Yeah. We don't want to stylize
Amazing.
It or anything like that. I'm like, oh, man, I'm never going to get
Damn.
Rid of this thing.
It's following you
don't
around.
It's terrifying. My dad grew a moustache at 15 to get in the pub, because he thought all my friends are getting in and I'm not getting in, and he's had it ever since. And he shaved it off once when me and my sister were kids, and we went absolutely fucking insane. Yeah. He walked in the door and we just screamed, cried. He was like, it's me. We were like, it's not you.
Such
and
a
he had to like hide
it?
For a few days until he grew his moustache back. We absolutely lost our
mind. Yeah, it becomes a part of someone, doesn't it?
Yeah.
When I had a period...
Imagine my dad with no moustache. He'd have a big white...
Yeah.
When I had a period of growing beards and shaving them off, so before I left retail... And my mate Stu would always say, every time you shave it off, your eyes just become huge, like an alien kind of. Because again, because it is, I guess it's framing the face more, isn't it? So if there's suddenly more space, he was like, it's weird, I can't
It's like
it.
When you have your braces off, when I have my train tracks off, at school and you feel like your teeth are massive and everyone's like, go on, show us. And you're like, no, I've got massive teeth.
And they feel so soft. It's really weird, isn't it? Yeah. Yeah, they're transformative. I once like went on a couple of dates for someone who had a beard and then he got rid of it. And I was like, oh, I don't fancy you anymore.
Oh, it's mad.
You look completely different.
Oh, men that take their facial hair off are insane.
Yeah.
It's like, don't do that to
me. Pressure to never take that off now.
Yeah. Never, you're not allowed ever.
Don't do it. It's so easy as well.
We need to really tenuously link between your beard to Christmas. Father Christmas is somewhere in there.
Easy.
But I think we're just gonna have to clumsily talk about Christmas because
we're gonna have to get in. Yeah, Sunday's Christmas. We've got about 7 minutes.
I think Christmas is a Sunday this year.
Shut up.
It is a tradition on Christmases for me now since about 4 years ago when my goddaughter got me beard baubles. I now have to put my beard baubles in and send a photo to my goddaughter every year now. So yeah, I've got beard baubles that you clip on, you clip them in.
Oh, I'm getting my brother some. That's amazing.
Oh, yeah.
So there's our tenuous link to beards and Christmases.
That's fucking great. But smash it. It's almost like you've done this before.
I'm pretty sure Christmas is Sunday, isn't it?
It is.
No, he did say that. Yeah, he did confirm. You brought it up. Pip confirmed. What does your Christmas look like? I go back to Wales. You go back to Winchester, don't you? What's your vibe?
It all kind of changed last year because me and my partner have rescued a dog now.
Your dog's beautiful.
I am obsessed with
your
dog.
He's a key part.
Stunning.
And I honestly
think, he's gorgeous.
Again, one of the reasons I was really up for this chat on the Christmas run, because it's a weird one, because I've had a weird relationship with Christmas, because for a while I wasn't that into it, but then my brother stopped celebrating Christmas because he feels it's a religious holiday and it feels almost disrespectful, in his opinion, to jump on a religious holiday when you're not religious, if you know what I mean. He's like, I don't get everyone round for Ramadan and do a thing that's completely unrelated to Ramadan. So that's his choice and I understand that, but it meant, because him and my mum lived together, it meant my mum kind of felt she had to tone down Christmas a bit initially anyway. And it's like, he doesn't hate Christmas, he's just not personally celebrating, he's not being militant about it, but it meant I turned Christmas up to 11 to compensate, because I was like, I still want my mum to feel Christmassy and to enjoy Christmas and to not feel that she can't enjoy Christmas. So yeah, I've got more Christmassy, but last Christmas, I think we nailed Christmas Day. So I'll take you through
it. Oh my God,
it.
Tell us. So please.
Got up nice and early, obviously had a Santa sack for Finley, our dog, loads of excitement. Then I cooked up a load of bacon and brie rolls, wrapped them in tin foil, then went and met my dad and brother for a walk of Finley. So me, my partner, my dad and brother all going for a nice early morning country walk, frost on the grass.
I love it.
I'm whipping bacon and brie rolls out of my bag that are all wrapped in tin foil. So a nice breakfast start. And then it was back to mine where I was hosting Christmas. But the reason we were hosting it was because my mum's got a cat. So bringing Finley round to the cat is going to cause mayhem probably. But I've not got the biggest ovens, so my mum dealt with the turkey, and that's the boring bit.
The fun bit is
all the different veg and the potatoes and the desserts and all that. So I got to host Christmas only doing the fun bit and just had loads of veg and loads of different dilda Yorkshires and all that kind of thing. And then everyone came round, and we had a lovely time, ate loads of food.
It's like a coming of age Christmas story. Yeah. It's like you get to host the adult, the kid gets to host.
But still getting
and do
to
the
miss
fun
it.
Bit.
Still getting my mum to do the
exactly.
turkey bit.
Yeah.
That you have to start really early for.
Games afterwards.
Yeah, we collapsed in front of the TV for a bit, and then we played a Christmas game that we've never played before. And I'm not sure if you're familiar with it, but it's an obsession of mine. But do you watch No More Jockeys at all? It's on YouTube. It's Tim Key, Mark Watson and Alex Horn. It's a game that they invented. Honestly, I can't recommend watching it enough. It's a silly kind of word game that they invented on tour, I think. But it's amazing. It's basically, the very basics is, I will say, for example, Losey Pinder, no more podcasters. And then we can't... Then the next person has to name someone, but we can't name any more podcasters. So you couldn't pick me, for example. So the next person could pick... Tom Hardy, no more actors. And then
right.
the next person can pick Childish Gambino, no more musicians. But then they're out because Gambino's an actor. So you're out.
Oh,
so,
I love
so
that.
So you're
That's
out
cool.
because you pick no more because you've broken that
That's
rule.
Class.
So when it goes round two or three times and you've picked no more people
Plato,
from the,
no
the,
more
the south of England.
And
a famous one on No More Jockeys is a Tim Key picking Lady Penelope, no more job gloves. So no more people have to wear gloves for their job. And again, it just gets more and more. And it's, yeah, we played that with my mum, dad, a brother and, yeah, everyone. And, yeah, it was...
I'm not sure my nan had cottoned on to
that.
That
was
I think
the
I
thing,
might have to stick to names on foreheads.
My mum and dad have tried to watch it and couldn't really get their heads around it. Me and my brother were obsessed. But playing it, it was a lot easier. And like it's like any game.
Yeah.
As soon as you start playing it, you're like, all right, yeah, this makes sense. And, yeah. So, yeah, that's become I hope is going to be our traditional Christmas game now.
Yeah, it's going to be mine now. Thanks for that. Because we're a big game.
And they're
we're
all
big
on
games fans.
They've
got,
has a game. Done, like, five series or five full, like, each series has, like, five or six episodes or whatever. They're all on YouTube. And they're, honestly, it's hilarity.
That's cracking stuff.
Love it.
And what's your bit in between Christmas and New Year like? Do you have that bit of a lull? Like I find New Year slightly melancholy,
that,
so I have to go and do some. I make a point of going to do something nice and being with people that I because I find New Year a bit odd.
I've solved that problem by the fact that on New Year's Day I record my Films of the Year podcast, so that gap is catching up on any films that I feel might be in there.
Nice.
Because again. The first year I did the Films of the Year podcast, it was just awash with people saying, well, you clearly didn't see this, or you should have watched that, or this should be on your list. So I now try and watch practically every film that comes out. And it's perfect in that gap because most things have made their way onto streaming services or whatever because they know everyone's at home in that period. So
I normally
have a kind of a good period of just eating appallingly and getting through tons of films so that I... can't be caught out too much on my Films of the Year. So
what a good plan. I was going to say favourite Christmas song.
You see, this is a tough one because I count... This is a bit, is Die Hard a Christmas film? Straight to Hell by The Clash. It's not like listed as a Christmas song, but it references Christmas and I always feel it has a real Christmas feel. So I had that written down in my prep. And then I realised that up until the pandemic, anyway, my Christmas Eve tradition was go to the pub that's about a 30-minute walk from me. I live in a rough area. There's only one nice pub and it's not near me. So the pub that's about a 30-minute walk up a hill, get drunk, and then normally walk home on my own and I would listen to a song called Oi to the World by a punk band called The Vandals. So it's essentially a rewrite of Joy to the World, but it's by a punk band.
I was massive into punk
I'd
when I was younger.
To that
I'm going
to
listen
on
to
the
that
on the way
Vandals
home.
One.
Very tipsy, trying not to fall down the hill. So that's got to be my favourite Christmas song because I've listened
to that. Oh, I love
that
as a tradition.
That's class. The joy of being a man, being able to do that.
Yeah. I know.
I went out for a walk with a male friend of mine. We were out and it was dark. It was pitch black and I was like, it was really exhilarating. And I was like, this feels... Why do I never do this? Why do I never come out? And I was like, I remember. So because I'm a woman.
Yeah.
And
I'm going to rein it back slightly and say I used my patriarchal privilege by what I'd normally do. The reason I'd leave the pub on my own early is because I'd pop a little... Santa sack round to my mum's house because my parents are separated and it used to be my parents would get them each other a Santa sack and then we'll do our main presents in the evening. So I've taken on the mantle of being the anonymous Santa. So I'd walk home drunk and then grab this sack and sneak it into my mum's and then go off and
you're using
bed.
Your powers for
this
good.
This is such a lovely
so I
tradition.
Use
so
the patriarchal
nice.
Powers for good.
Yeah, you have,
you do.
Yeah, I think
you
do.
You always do,
and
actually.
This is something, actually, this is why, I mean, we love you for that, is when you do kind of clock those men, especially on social media, that when these things do come up, you and Stu as well, I always kind of, you always make a mental note of like, oh yeah, they.
Oh, we know all the men that.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, all of them. Yeah.
Favourite Christmas film?
Favourite Christmas film?
Die Hard is a Christmas film, as is Edward Scissorhands.
Yeah, I, again, Die Hard is the last part of that tradition. I'd, after dropping off the Santa sack, I drunk watched Die Hard on Christmas Eve. So it's probably that. But, oh, this is going to kill me. And I'll let you know afterwards. But there's a film I can't remember the name of that my brother showed me. And this really steers into my typical bleakness. But I think it's from about the 60s. And it's about a hitman who's doing a hit on Christmas Eve. But it's in his hometown. And he has this kind of, not a Christmas Carol type thing, but he bumps into some people and it makes him question if he wants to be a hitman anymore. And it's really good.
I've seen this. This is ringing an absolute bell for me.
It's a great concept.
I've got a blank on the name of it, but I'll look it up and I'll come
back.
Let's both
look it up because, yeah,
it was really good.
I've
and it's
definitely
one of them
seen it.
That it's, Christmas is key to it. So it's not just like, my brother argues that Die Hard isn't a Christmas film because he feels
it's snowing
at
it.
Christmas, but it's not a key part of the film, if you know what I mean. But I disagree.
Oh, I have this argument.
I think it is because they're having a Christmas party.
Home Alone. Home Alone's about child abuse. That could be any time of year. Like, they've just left him at home, so they've forgotten about him. Like, the fact that there's a tree in that and he uses the decorations to, like, hurt the burglar's feet is kind of irrelevant, 100%. Really. Like, he's been left at home on his own. You can say it about anything.
It's me with Edward Scissorhands. I'm like, the whole end of the film is set at Christmas and there's snow in it. It's a Christmas film and everyone's like, no, it's not. I'm like, it is. It's my favourite
If you want to fucking
Christmas
watch
film.
It at Christmas, it's a Christmas film.
Yeah, I want to add something I heard on the Dream Factory podcast. They were saying, obviously, The Muppets Christmas Carol is the best Christmas film in reality, but...
I don't like The Muppets.
Oh, this
so
is a tough thing, because they were saying that any Muppets film is great at Christmas. And I think Muppets films have a Christmassy tone and vibe, but obviously Lucy isn't going to be on board with this.
Not for me.
I'm slightly indifferent about them. I don't hate them.
I find Kermit and Miss Piggy so irritating. The others, like, animals.
The others.
Is Animal a Muppet?
Yeah.
The drummer.
Yeah, I love
Animal. I find Kermit and Miss Piggy unbelievably irritating.
Yeah, I guess couples are, though.
Yeah, couples are.
Yeah. couples are unbelievably irritating. We'll leave on that because that's a nice Christmas message.
Yeah,
what's
Merry
your favourite Christmas message? I don't know, couples are irritating. So whenever our friends get a boyfriend or girlfriend, we're like, oh, we don't want to be friends with them now.
I mean, as a regular listener, I need to give you my Sunday track. Because I've listened and I've not heard it come up yet, and I think it's a song that is so made, it feels so Sunday to me, but it's Redbone by Childish Gambino.
Oh,
yeah. Huge fans
it's
of Childish Gambino over here.
Just Sunday feeling track. Sexy Sunday feeling, but Sunday nonetheless. I just think
beautiful,
it's an absolute
choice.
It's such a good, just in the morning, in the afternoon, in the evening, it's so, yeah.
It's very like, yes, summer Sunday with that on. We went to see Childish Gambino. Was it the O2? Mm. And I think Beth had an out-of-body experience.
I went as well.
Big time.
I went with my goddaughter.
Did you?
My goddaughter and her mum.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Yeah, I did have an out-of-body experience. I'm obsessed
with
him.
Amazing, right?
Incredible. And I love that song. I just thought, as you said, Sexy Sundays. We should do, you know, like they do Late Night Hollyoaks. We should do Late Night Smashing Sundays and call it Sexy Sundays.
Yes.
Smashing Sundays.
Yes.
Hollyoaks where
nights.
We just put on sexy voices and talk about it.
Hollyoaks Night!
Yeah, yeah,
oh
yeah.
Oh, my God, remember Hollyoaks
we should do,
Night.
We need to earmark this.
Okay.
Before you go, because we don't want
to
keep you
any
longer.
We could talk to you forever.
But... I do need to like call back to the Twitch thing because I genuinely don't know what it is. And like, I'm a bit avoidant about it. I want you to like, tell me what it is and like, where can people, like, are you doing them over Christmas and things? Like, what is it?
I will be doing some. It's basically, it's a streaming platform. Like, that's all it is.
So it's just a live...
It's a live streaming platform. And that's what's been exciting about it because the bulk of people use it to play computer games. And I do a fair bit of that on there because that's what I'd watched... I was watching David Earl on there. He'd play as Brian Gittins and as Cumbo and as David Earl. So
I did. Do you remember when I did the Brian Gittins podcast? Mm. It was like a fever dream.
Yeah.
So him and Limmy are the two who've kind of drawn me in because they're both comedians I'm a fan of. And then Limmy, sometimes he'll just be watching YouTube clips and commenting on it. It's what's got Alistair Green is going to be launching a Twitch soon because he's watched a lot of Limmy just comment on stuff. But yeah, you can kind of do what you want. I'm going to send you to a link to... I've uploaded one of my streams onto YouTube because I did a Halloween stream. And it kind of... I think it kind of shows what you can do with the platform. I did a Halloween stream. There's some spooky woods near me that we used to go to as kids, but I've not been as a grown-up because I think I've got more scares. So I live-streamed from the spooky woods.
No, you didn't.
And it, Blair and it went... I've called it the Blair Twitch Project, so yeah.
Nice!
Yeah.
I've
uploaded it to YouTube, but in the intro, the reason I mention it is in the intro, I give a quick little... There's a few things that will be confusing. Here's what they mean. Because again, it's like anything. The first time you go on most social media, or when your fucking iPhone updates, everything's confusing for a week.
Yeah.
And then it's not. And that's the thing with Twitch. I think the first time you go on, it's probably overwhelming because people are talking about subs and emotes and all sorts of sound alerts and stuff. And you think, I don't know what's going on. But you watch a bit and it just becomes, second nature. So, yeah, people are like Richard Herring's on there doing his podcast every now and then. So there's loads of ways to use it. I think there's going to be a boom in it for comedians or for all sorts of other stuff because it is just...
So we could stream this live. Like, if we 100%. Wanted to do stuff us too, that would actually probably be good for us.
So we need to get into Twitch. 2023 is the year of the Twitch.
Yeah.
Hit me up. I'll tell you everything you need to know.
Thank you.
We'll talk.
I do think that'd be good for us.
Okay.
This is obviously a business chat that doesn't need to be on the podcast. thank you.
Oh, Pip, it's been a pleasure. There's so much stuff that we didn't even... We'll have to get you back on.
Always none of my up notes.
Yeah, thank you so
it's
much.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you, guys. And thank you for all the episodes. As said, I'm an avid listener, so it's been a joy.
Oh, that's so nice.
Thank you for distraction pieces. I think it was one of the only ones that we listened to before we started doing podcasts.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, I love it. I really, really love them.
Inspiring.
So thank you.
Have a wonderful Christmas.
Yes, thank you.
Bye, love.